You're listening to Let's Get Legal, hosted by John Hanson and powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Today's show is sponsored by attorney Patrick Dolan from Conti and Dolan, attorney Michael Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers, and attorney Millie Palmer from Navigant Law Group. Now, here's John Hanson, and let's get legal.
At 111 on WGN, very happy Saturday afternoon now. And it's sunny outside. It started a little cloudy today. It's a little cooler, of course. But Mike Leonard, I will take a sunny day here in late April, right?
I'll take it too, John. It's kind of exciting. It's a little bit chilly out there, but yeah. I love the sunshine.
Love the sunshine. Put me in a good mood. I did some mulching today before I came on. And you hate yard work and things.
If you had my wife on the show, she'd say I hate all work around the house.
You do.
My biggest house project in probably the last 6 months was this week. I went to Jewel and bought a bottle of Drano because one of our sinks was clogged. But I waited literally like a month to do that.
To do it?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. I felt like it made shaving easier because it retained that water, you know? So I didn't think it was a bad thing. My wife disagreed.
Yeah, she did. And you got the Drano. Did it work?
It worked pretty well, yeah. It seems to be cleared, you know? I didn't know which one to go to. Drano, what's the other one they always advertise on TV?
I don't know. Either way, it seems like now that you could be a guest on Home Sweet Home Chicago or perhaps Lou Manfredini. You're basically Mr. Fix-It now.
Absolutely, yeah. Give me a call, everybody.
Yeah, right. You're a federal defense attorney. You do great work in that sphere. You're a man that brings us sandwiches, I don't want to say every single time. That'd be too much, Mike. You got to keep it as a surprise. But this is two times in a row. Where do you get these again?
La Petito over on Huron. Love the place. Discovered it in law school. I've been going there for like 30 years. And, John, let's just be honest with the viewers. Listeners, you tell me I must bring you a sandwich. You say, you text me things like, I am John Hanson, you will bring me a sandwich, it will be roast beef. So let's just get that out there. You're not this nice, kind guy you try to portray yourself on WGN, like soft and friendly.
The listeners know. I met a lot of them at AmeriCash yesterday, by the way. Quick shout out to Brian the Cash Man for hosting our event and the WGN listeners. We had a lot of them waiting at the front door when we started the Cash Bash at 4 p.m. on a Friday during rush hour after it had rained a bunch. People were coming from all over the Western Burbs and beyond to see what their stuff was worth. And they kept on coming till about 6 o'clock last night. It was a really great turnout, and it was so nice to meet so many great WGN radio listeners. It took me, I think, an hour and 45 minutes to get there after I left from John Williams' show.
Wait, can you tell me? I don't know what this is. What was the event?
Yeah, I forgot to send the invite to you. So one of our frequent guests on Your Money Matters is Brian the Cash Man. He runs AmeriCash Gold and Coin, where he collects and pays you for your stuff, whether it's gold coins, watches. But he's just this really great family guy. It's a generational store. And he also will buy like sports memorabilia. Like a lot of places are just like only your gold. He'll buy sports memorabilia, little quirky things, because he'll be able to find sellers for them. So he comes on the program once every other week already, and he takes people's calls, how much is your stuff worth? And we decided to do like an in-person event yesterday at AmeriCash, and also because it's like right by my house. He's out in Westmont, I'm in Downers Grove, and it was a lot of fun. It was cool. So
a big turnout?
Oh, yeah. People came, brought a lot of stuff. So one couple brought just a bunch of coins and stuff they had not even collected. They had been handed down from generations. It was just sitting in their closet along with a few pots. One of them turned out to be sterling silver. The coins, when they had so much of them, a couple of them were worth a couple $100. I think they walked away with near $2,000.
See, I've always had these baseball cards sitting in the basement for like literally 20, 30, 40 years now.
Wow.
And I've always wanted to know if they're valuable or not. And I don't know, like, who do you really go to? Because if they're really valuable, is the guy going to really say,
yes,
oh, that's really valuable, let me give you a bunch of money? So I don't know what to do.
Brian Hogevane will do that. Yeah. Trust me. He's talked about it. He doesn't even like me to tell these stories, but some of competitors, he's like a WGN listener brought in, I don't remember the exact amount, but I think brought in a coin that Brian bought for, I think it was $30,000.
Wow.
The previous person, and the guy had gone to Brian for a second opinion, the previous guy that had looked at the coin offered like $8,000.
Man, that's good for Brian. That shows he's an honest broker.
Well, he talks about that a lot, too. He's like, this is a family business. My father always imparted, pay the fair price. You're going to get more customers that way. People will trust you. Anyways, it was a great event out there. Boy, we're getting a lot of texts about the greatest mystery
that people want
to know about.
Can I throw mine out there before we go to the text
line? Go ahead. Yeah.
I got two.
All right. Well, okay, give us your first one.
Look, even when I was young, I read all the books about the Kennedy assassination. I recently, a couple years ago, went to near Dealey Plaza and saw that on the street.
Yeah.
Which is really amazing because that building is so not big.
It's small. The whole area seems smaller.
The fact that someone could be in the window and no one would notice is crazy. But I know most of the facts are decided and probably undisputed, but I just want to know the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Like, for example, what were Oswald's connections to others? Did he really have, you know, was he really working with others, which I suspect he had to be. I know you disagree.
I disagree.
Someone else had to be involved. But I just want to know the complete,
the whole
unblemished
story.
Truth. Yeah.
I think it was Lee Harvey Oswald acting solo. And the conspiracies are, everyone finds out about conspiracies.
Well, it doesn't have
government
to be,
can't keep secrets.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be a giant web like the movie, but I don't buy that there was no connection between him and anybody else. I don't believe that. Mm. Secondly,
okay,
this is a dumb one, I guess, but I still want to know the Joan Benet thing. You know, JonBenet Ramsey.
Yeah,
I just want to give me the facts.
We talked about that beforehand. I'm not going to hypothesize who I think did it because, you know, I don't want to blast that out there. But I think I know the resolution of the case after the latest documentary that came out a couple years ago. I'll tell you off the air.
Okay.
And if anyone that watched the most recent one a couple years ago, I think people kind of feel the same way.
They pointed the fingers strongly at somebody.
There's a pretty strong case of who it was.
Can I ask you this? Did they point to a family member?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Anyways. All right. Good questions. Someone, 708, made fun of me for Stonehenge. but they said, and this is a couple of people have said, what is the meaning of life? Okay, that's a deep one, including the 847 says, is there life after death?
Yes, I would like to know that too.
Well, we're all going to find out. That's one I guess we all get to find out eventually,
but
right?
You don't get to tell anybody who's still living. That's
no.
The problem.
No. 815 wants to know about like Nostradamus and all of his predictions. Was there some sort of anything happening there for him to really know?
Yeah, I like that.
One texter, 773, says Center Guard Plumbing. No, that was from the Hochberg show. I can tell you, Center Guard Plumbing, there's no mystery there. Those guys are awesome. They've been at my house like five times as I've navigated my
50-year-old
house.
In there.
Yeah, that was from the previous show. By any chance, would you have the name of the honest coin dealer that I was just mentioned? Yes, Brian Hogevane. Brian the Cash Man. He's at AmeriCash, 16 West Ogden in Westmont. You can also call his store directly and you can text like your coins into 630-969-9600. I'll put that in the text message. Iridian, what's the one mystery in the world you want solved?
I want to know what happened with D.B. Cooper.
Ooh, the guy who jumped out of the plane.
Yes.
Yeah, but did you not see? They had a show about that a couple months ago.
Where?
I think it's kind of solved.
Oh.
No, yeah, there was a guy who, they had a lot of the stuff like in his attic. And so they interviewed the family. They have a lot of the, you know, similar parachute stuff and all that. So I think the authorities think they have solved that. That person is not alive anymore. So I think they think they've cracked that one.
Well, they think, but who knows?
Yeah, you got to watch the documentary.
I now have to watch that documentary.
We'll get your judgment on that.
Why does that one fascinate you already?
I don't know. I just think it's such a cool story. Like, they ended up giving the guy the money. They gave him the four parachutes, and he just jumped out of the plane
was
ready to go. Like, in his head, I just want to know, what was going on? Like, for you to ask for that much money and be like, yeah, I'm going to jump out of a plane.
Yes.
Let's do this.
A commercial airliner.
Yeah, I love the fact that he did it. It's just amazing.
It's wild.
Yeah.
I know they recovered some of the money, right, that had scattered about.
I don't know, but I don't remember from that documentary, but I feel like they do believe they have, even though he's dead, the guy identified.
That's a good one. Someone texted in 847, have aliens visited Earth? Ooh, that's a good mystery to solve. Not as many true crime coming in. I thought more people would want to do that. I think someone texted in Jimmy Hoffa, that mystery.
Yeah, where is that guy buried? That's crazy.
Keep them coming, though. 312-981-7200. Tell you what, let's take our break here right now. We'll get more of your calls. You can call in, too, with your thoughts. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney here, too. We will talk about the case in Wisconsin, about the judge who was arrested by the FBI. We'll dive into that and some local issues and other stuff as well. John Hansen here. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I got on a little podcast of Amelia Earhart and thought, oh, you know, what is the greatest mystery out there that you would want solved? A lot of crime ones, too. So that's how I tied it to Let's Get Legal, Mike, and able to talk it here.
Here's John, the way you make the connections is unbelievable.
630, Malaysia Airlines 370.
That one, funny thing, I couldn't identify the airliners, the particular airline, but that came into my head. That one is pretty fascinating.
Someone wanted to know about Jack the Ripper, and there was news about that a couple weeks ago, that some DNA, and amazingly, that had survived in one of the cloths of the, I think, one of the victims. They did some family genealogical DNA connections. They can do that now to identify a very likely suspect. I don't have the exact information on the tip of my tongue with it. Google Jack the Ripper 708 and look for recent news articles.
Was it consistent with the theory that
yes.
they... Okay, because
which theory?
I thought Jack the Ripper. I thought going back historically, they had a theory. It was like someone who was well-to-do, professional, medical, all that sort of stuff. Like, is it consistent with the historical theory?
Yeah, I'll have to read the whole article again. Okay. Mike. Sorry, let me look.
Go past the first paragraph next time, John. but thanks for the insight.
847 were extraterrestrials involved in history, like pyramids, calendars, markings viewed only from the air. That's a good one.
Oh, I like it.
Enrique loves Ancient Aliens on the History Channel. I abhor it. I can't stand it.
And Do they provide legitimate insight in the show?
I'm going to get in trouble if I say no, but I don't think so.
Well, maybe he's not listening.
It's a lot of conjecture.
Yeah.
And just like these open-ended statements. Could it have been this?
Yeah.
And then they have some guy who obviously thinks that it was.
Yeah.
Going, well, of course it could have been this. And then they'll like sneak in little lines on Ancient Aliens. They'll be like, now science hasn't verified any of this X, Y, and Y.
Do they wait to the very end to say that?
Or like right before commercial, they'll just like slip in a little like, now of course experts vehemently disagree.
And are they still pumping out episodes or is this all old stuff?
Dude, I do not know. I'm okay. Sorry. Someone will know. A couple local ones. Donna texted in the Valerie Percy case. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. Chuck Percy's daughter.
Senator, yep. Was, Kenilworth.
Yeah. So she was murdered, but was she taken out of the house first? I can't remember what the facts were.
No, she was found in her, I don't know exactly the case, but this is back in 1966, and she was found murdered in her North Suburban home and was, of course, the daughter of then-candidate Chuck Percy.
That one seems very suspicious because it's, I mean, especially now with the technological advances and cold cases, like it just seems like they would know. I don't know.
Right. I don't know. There's a lot of theories. I don't want to like wax poetic about theories here and get anyone not in trouble. I don't want to get myself in trouble, I guess is what I'm saying here. I don't need a libel suit on my hands.
You and W and Jin don't need that next defamation suit.
A case that I didn't know about was candy heiress Helen Voorhees Brock.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Helen Brock, a couple people texted in, was last seen. She left an appointment at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota in 1977, had a routine checkup, was given a clean bill of health, and she essentially disappeared after that.
Yeah, it's funny because every one of these, you remember portions of it. And I thought in that one, wasn't it tied to like the horse racing guys, the horse track guys or something like
there
that?
There is, yeah. The puzzle remains largely unexplained. I'm reading an old Tribune article. But then in 2005, former Chicago horseman Joe Plemons, who had testified, confessed to authorities and the Tribune that he had shot the heiress twice before he took the body to a steel mill. And although that there are some officials at ATF, the U.S. Bureau of ATF, believe the story, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office declined to bring charges based on his confession alone.
Yeah, because if you don't, that's the problem. If you don't have any corroboration, no physical evidence, nothing else to do it, you don't necessarily, you can't necessarily bring a case. Plus, they probably felt like at his age and whatever that they didn't need to prosecute him, you know?
Right. 630 says, I was surprised to learn that they never found out who the Zodiac Killer was, at least last I heard. That's another one where there's a very strong theory in the case. If you watch documentaries or movies, they point to someone pretty exclusively who they think it was. And they do that in the movie, too, which was a great movie, the Jake Gyllenhaal movie.
It's funny because I didn't even know the Zodiac Killer wasn't caught. So was that in New York as well?
No, San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
San Francisco.
And what's the theory as to why Did they think the person died, or what's the theory of what happened to the person?
Oh my God, you're like scratching my memory as if I know all this stuff off the top of my head. Yeah. I don't, but the theory was is that because he would write letters still for years afterwards, remember correctly.
Yeah.
And then they stopped, and I think they think
he's maybe dead. A listener knows what the theory is of why he stopped or whatever.
You're just asking for things beyond the first paragraph from Mike today, and I really
sounds like the depth of your knowledge today, John, is very thin.
Yes. Well, what you're slowly realizing is that radio hosts, we know things a mile wide and an inch deep.
You just throw it out there for people to comment on, you know, and then pretend like you knew the answer. You're like Alex Trebek, like as if you knew the answer.
No, right, or the question, you mean. Not the answer. You didn't get the joke.
I'm not. I got the joke, but I'm not really a fan of the show, so it's kind of...
Wait, hold on. You're not a fan of Jeopardy?
No. Sorry. I know I'm going to get a lot of backlash. Literally my whole life, I've probably watched Jeopardy one time, not even a full episode. I just never cared. I don't know why.
Well, maybe
John,
give it one more shot. There's been about 7,000 episodes. You've watched one of them.
I'll go back and watch another.
Did you just not know any of the answers and you got sad?
Also, Pat Sajak's show, I don't care about that either.
He's not hosting anymore. Oh, you can watch it with Ryan Seacrest.
Oh, yeah, because I remember Aaron Rodgers wanted to be the host. I can tell you that.
312-981-7200. We're getting more texts. What happened to Jimmy Hoffa? That's a good one. The Grimes sisters. I don't know that case. I'll have to look it up.
Meridian's indicating she knows something about that. What do you know?
Well, let's get to the newsroom first with our news, and we'll have more Let's Get Legal. I promise we'll talk about some legal stuff. Talking about the biggest mystery. Some are like true crime. Some are more deeper questions of life that you would want solved. I picked Amelia Earhart. Someone picked Malaysian Airlines 370. Mike, there was a text, and a lot of people will remember this, and this was in the news recently. I think it was the Trib or the Sun-Times. My apologies for not remembering. But they did a deep dive on the 40th anniversary of the Chicago Tylenol murders.
Oh, yeah.
That was huge.
Real good podcast on that came out about maybe 6 months ago. I think the two women who did it were, they might have been former writers for Tribune or Sun-Times. They did like a 4 to 6 podcast series. It was really well done.
I think most people know this case, but if you don't, it was in our area, the Chicago metropolitan area, victims, different homes consuming Tylenol that had been laced with cyanide, and 7 people died in the original, but it all happened really quickly, and paramedics and medical examiners quickly put together that it was, oh my goodness, there was cyanide in Tylenol. And Mike, you have a memory of this, right?
Yeah, John, I don't want to age myself too much because I know people view me as more like a 30-year-old. But
right.
I was in high school in 1982 in Arlington Heights at St. Vider. And they, like all the other schools, came on the, what do you call that?
The loudspeaker.
The loudspeaker. And it went through all the classrooms like, hey, if you have any Tylenol, bring it down to the office. And the second thing, which was even more maybe chilling, was they had like the police cars driving slowly down the streets with the megaphone thing telling people the same thing, which is pretty crazy, you know, because one of them happened pretty close to our house. So like we live in Arlington Heights, but that was like Des Plaines. But that was a big one. But the podcast, I think, went pretty close to thinking they know who it is, this one individual who the feds thought it was. But the guy was also sort of viewed as not credible in some
taking
other respects.
For his,
yeah, it was hard to say. Like, I think his credibility was always questioned a little bit. But I think, as the podcast reveals, I think he's probably the most likely candidate.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about all these true crime cases that aren't quote-unquote solved, a lot of times I bet if you ask detectives, maybe you ask 4 of them, they'd be like, oh, we're pretty sure. But it doesn't meet the standard that prosecutors would need to charge someone.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, the prosecutor has to look at the case of, okay, yeah, we like all that evidence that you can piece it all together. It's all circumstantial. It all makes sense. But do we have a real solid good faith basis and belief that we're going to be able to get a conviction that we can prove, you know, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt?
Someone texted in the Grimes sisters, which you and I did not know that case. But Iridian, you've heard of the Grimes sisters case, even though it goes back to the 50s, which was about 50 so years before you were born.
Yes.
How did you know? This is a Chicago case, right?
Yeah. So I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. That's another fun fact about me. I listen to Crime Weekly, and every week they post a different story and they cover it like fully. They'll have maybe up to 6 parts of breaking down a story. So the Grimes sisters were 2 sisters who were murdered here, and their killer was just never found. So that's still pending. That's crazy.
I wonder if they've ever done any of the, you know, going back and, well, who knows if the evidence box still exists, but did they ever go back and try to do a cold case on it and try to see if there's any DNA or anything like that? And Iridian, I got to tell you, you got to listen to the podcast 1 minute remaining. You know why? Because I appear on that.
Oh, really? Yeah. Everyone should just be listening to WGN Radio. We have enough podcasts at WGNRadio.com, by the way.
There's more hours in a day, John.
Someone wondered, of all the cases you guys are talking about, you're not talking about the judge arrested in Wisconsin case. So let's pivot to that. We can get back to big mysteries. Keep texting them in. We'll do some more in the 2 o'clock hour. But this is the big legal story, I think, of the day. I mean, there's a lot obviously going on with the Trump administration and arguments against courts. This kind of battle between the executive and judicial branch playing itself out in cases with ICE and deportations. Seemingly every day or at least once a week, there's a new story where these two branches of government are butting heads. And the headline flashed across yesterday. I was in for John Williams, that the FBI had arrested a Milwaukee County judge. And I think everyone kind of gets their, gets their ears up because they're like, oh my gosh, this is the executive branch arresting a member of the judiciary branch. And when I kept on reading more of the details of the case, it wasn't that I was placated or found it to be A-okay. But it wasn't like they were arresting her because of opinion she wrote or something along those lines, right, Mike?
Yeah, correct. So it would be extremely distressing if someone got arrested for their opinion, which
right.
I don't think would ever happen under any administration. But no, the facts, basic facts as I know them, and you can help me more if you can go beyond the first paragraph, John, is my understanding is, first of all, the case was not in front of the judge. The immigration case was not in front of the judge. That would have been... You know, if it was an immigration court, that'd be federal. So this is a state court judge in Wisconsin.
Judge Hannah Dugan.
Didn't have the case. However, the facts or the allegations are that the judge was aware that I believe ICE agents were seeking to detain the person who was in court on a different case.
It was a misdemeanor battery case.
Yeah.
For 29-year-old Mexican national Eduardo Flores Ruiz.
Correct. And then the allegations are apparently in the indictment that the judge assisted that person or lawyer go out a back door or side door, and apparently the person was apprehended anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, it's a little different than I think people first thought when they saw the headline, oh, now we're arresting judges, so, you know, in general. So it's not that. However, from my standpoint, that's not obstruction of justice. I think anybody can do anything to let anyone out any door that they want, and I don't think it's obstruction of justice.
Really?
So
So she's been charged with obstructing or impeding the arrest of an undocumented person and concealing the person to prevent the man's arrest. She knew ICE agents were outside. She knew they were after the man in her courtroom, and she said, go this way, and you won't interact with them.
I don't think it rises to the level of obstruction. I don't. Obviously, you disagree with me. But
well, I guess I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is I want to hear more of the facts about what happened. Was this a thing that happened consistently? I also don't know if this needed to rise to the level of arresting a federal judge. Maybe there's other mechanisms that could have happened, warnings, or I don't really know. So I'm not making a point about whether this arrest should have happened or not. But that seems like to me. Hey, I know this person that wants you over here. They're trying to get you. Go out this door instead, and you are a federal judge or
you're
a judge.
Well, but yeah, but
you're a person that upholds the law.
Well, take away that person's title and their robes, just whoever it is. I don't think that conduct rises to the level of federal obstruction of justice. I don't think it does. I think it'll be a tough case to prove. But I think also equally important, since the apprehended the guy right outside the courthouse anyways, I think it was more a shot across the bow to judges and people in general. And I view it as something more than just, oh, we think we have a case here. I think there was more to it than that, in my view.
Yeah, I don't know. I we'll have to see more. And I do worry that this could have a broader, like, this is a message being sent.
Yes.
By the administration or by the FBI. Trying to say, and I don't think they're trying to say, don't rule against us, although I don't know if that's sort of maybe the vibe, but maybe it's, hey, we are trying to operate within what we view as the law and do not take extraordinary steps to try and shield people from the justice that we are seeking against them.
Well, it'd be very different if the person was concealed or secreted somewhere else or whatever. But I don't think that particular conduct rises to the level of a crime. And I obviously some people will disagree, maybe even you. But I think it's more of a shot across the bow.
Right. But I think we can suffice to say that this is not a constitutional crisis. I think a lot of people, or do you feel like it could be?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, anytime a judge is arrested, it's first of all, it's extraordinarily rare.
It does not happen.
The only times it really happens historically is when there's a situation, you know, involving bribery or something like that, right? Going back to Chicago Greylord days or, you know, something, some conduct along those lines. So it is a very unique circumstances, but they're doing it, in my view, because of their policy agenda. So people may disagree with that, but I think there's a political motivation to the prosecution, and I don't think that the conduct fits the federal crime of obstruction.
The FBI director, Kash Patel, did tweet and then, or X, whatever you want to say, and then delete a tweet about the arrest. What are your thoughts? Someone texted in 630 for saying that I don't, a lot of presumption of facts that are unknown by you, John, which is shocking. And then they said, and do we think it's appropriate for the FBI director to tweet about an ongoing case? I would prefer that no government officials of either party, of any one that's been appointed to anything, tweet or X about anything that's ongoing, personally. But does that get your riles up?
Oh, it really gets me riled up. And first of all, what did the tweet say? Do you know? Do we know?
Yeah, I did read it yesterday. Let me keep going. It said, oh, just now the FBI arrested Judge Hannah Dugan out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on charges of obstruction after evidence of Judge Dugan obstructing an immigrant arrest operation last week. We believe Judge Dugan intentionally misdirected federal agents away from the subject to be arrested in her courthouse, allowing the subject, an illegal alien, to evade arrest. He went on to write, thankfully, our agents chased down the perp on foot, describing the scene like he, so there you go.
Yeah, so look, that's not a fact-based, completely fact-based pronouncement, right? So here's what happens in literally every federal case across the country. The U.S. Attorney's Office issues like a factual statement.
Mm-hmm.
This person has been charged with this crime.
X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And
we thank the officials for...
Well, but no. But they do not characterize the person as a perp. They don't make statements that assumes they're guilty.
Hmm.
And they go out of their way in those press announcements, to their credit in some degree, to say that, of course, everyone is presumed innocent and these are just allegations, something along those lines. This is a member of law enforcement essentially characterizing it as if we got this person and they're guilty and they're a perp. I mean, which is absurd in my view. And there's a huge double standard in that prosecutors and members of law enforcement can make these public statements about people and even have press conferences about it. And if an attorney does it, they could get accused of you're trying to influence a jury. So that's why it gets me riled up.
I feel like prosecutors do this all the time, though.
They do, and I don't think it's appropriate. They do it all the time.
And they used to take, and they still do sometimes, take people on what they call perp walks.
Of course.
To get all the photos taken of the person. Look at who we got.
Yeah.
I don't think it's right, and I think that's probably why the FBI director deleted the post afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, why would, first of all, that's not even the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's a member of law enforcement going out of their way to not only suggest, but essentially say the person's guilty. All they've been done is charged with a crime and to characterize them as a perp and, you know, go out of their way to laud everybody. I mean, come on, that's absurd.
Karen Conti, who we know, Patrick Dolan's a law partner, and you've been on her show, was on with Lisa Dent yesterday. I was at AmeriCash, so I wasn't listening. But 815 said that Karen Conti had heard that the judge had not seen any direct warrant and was under no obligation to surrender him to the agents, meaning that one could make the argument that, yes, the judge showed the back door, but it wasn't as if the judge was presented with a warrant for this person's arrest saying, we're going after this guy, and she then went, aha, I've got a better idea. And that might be semantics, though, right, Mike? She's known agents have been in her courthouse or in the hallway before.
I think Karen makes a great point, because to prove the crime, to prove the actual offense, I mean, someone will say, oh, it's unethical or whatever, but to prove that offense, she would actually have to have knowledge of a proceeding. And so just the fact that someone said there's an ICE agent outside, you're not presented with any information that there's actual case, you're not presented with a warrant, so it is going to make it tough to prove that case guilty beyond a reasonable reasonable doubt. I think they're going to fail for that reason. I think Karen makes a great point.
But don't you think that's the judge saying, like, I don't agree politically with what's happening here in this country. I don't agree that ICE agents should be going after people and sending them back. And I'm taking a step to try and give this guy freedom.
Sure, but it's not a crime.
Okay. I don't know. Again, I don't know if the judge should have been arrested or not. It just, as I read the details of the case, I found myself questioning my own thoughts, which is not a bad thing to be at. Okay, we got to take a break. 150 on WGN. I'm sure people disagree with me. That's cool. 312-981-7200. Keep the comments and the calls coming. I saw we had a couple calls from Wisconsin. Did they just want to yell at me, Iridian? Yep, that's a big nod from Iridian. That's fine. I mean, I'm questioning myself all the time, too. And Mike, we're both getting calls telling us that we are wrong, which means I think we're arguing this on both sides of the equation here. Witnesses have told, we're talking about the arrest of the Wisconsin judge yesterday, where the FBI says that essentially the state judge, Judge Dugan, led a someone who was about to be arrested by ICE, and she knew it, through a back door, essentially. He was later arrested outside, but the judge arrested for obstruction in this case for what the prosecutors say, or what the FBI says, is that she knowingly knew that this person was going to be arrested by ICE, and she interfered in that arrest. Witnesses told investigators that Dugan confronted the federal agents, the judge, confronted the federal agents in the public hallway, where she repeatedly demanded that they leave, saying they needed a different kind of warrant to make that request. Dugan ordered the agents to speak with the chief judge of the courthouse. So it wasn't as if the judge, it appears, if you are to believe these witnesses and what the FBI contends, didn't know what the ICE agents were there for. And first of all, Mike, what, is it the judge's role to step in there and say, wait, do you have the correct warrant? Like, she's not the lawyer of the person that is being arrested.
That's correct. I mean, we could, you know, settle all debate by just kind of reading the key allegation from the criminal complaint. You want to do that?
Yeah. Do you have it in front of you?
Yeah. Here's what it says. So the allegations are in the criminal complaint that members of the arrest team reported the following events after Judge Dugan learned of the presence and left the bench. Judge Dugan and Judge A, who were both wearing judicial robes, approached members of the arrest team in the public hallway. Judge A's courtroom is located adjacent to Judge Dugan's courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Witnesses reported that Judge Dugan was visibly upset and had a confrontational, angry demeanor. Judge Dugan addressed deportation officer A and asked if
asked
if the officer was present for a court appearance.
Okay.
When the officer responded no, the judge stated that the deportation officer would need to leave the courthouse.
Okay.
Deportation officer stated the deportation officer was there to effectuate arrest. Judge Dugan asked if deportation officer A had a judicial warrant. The deportation officer responded, no, I have an administrative warrant. Judge Dugan stated that deportation officer A needed a judicial warrant. Deportation officer A told Judge Dugan that the deportation officer was in a public space and had a valid immigration warrant. Judge Dugan asked to see the administrative warrant, and the deportation officer offered to show it to her.
Okay.
Judge Dugan then demanded that deportation officer speak with the chief judge. Judge Dugan then had a similar conversation with FBI agent and a police officer. After finding out that they were not present for a court appearance and that they were with ICE, Judge Dugan order them to speak to the chief judge office.
Okay.
Now here's the thing.
Okay.
Judge A escorted members of the arrest team away from the courtroom, down the hall, and through a set of double doors towards the reception area of the chief judge's office.
Okay.
DEA agent B, who was not recognized by Judge Dugan and Judge A as being part of the arrest team, remained outside the courtroom. The courtroom deputy reported and observed a portion of the described events, blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's see.
Tell you what. Keep on reading.
We're almost there.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have the crux of it? Why don't you read it all.
Okay.
Summarize it after this break in the news.
It's probably a good idea, John.
Yeah. Well, listening to you read off your phone, the thing is, boy, it's not thrilling radio. But I want to get down to the bottom of this because this is an important case. And we've been chatting about the case that Sylvia Snowden told you about, too. The judge in Wisconsin, Judge Hannah Dugan, out of federal custody now. after appearing on two felony charges for what the government says is essentially showing the back door, a non-public back door of her court or courtroom to someone that was going to be arrested by ICE. Mike, you've read the federal complaint. Just summarize what the government says or what the FBI says that she did.
That's probably better than me boring you to tears by reading
whole thing. Yeah. That was an exciting 3 minutes in the last hour.
It was great.
Iridian, well, get that out in post-production.
When it comes down to it, the judge allegedly is aware of the presence of agents, the fact that they have a particular type of warrant to attempt to take the defendant in her courtroom into custody by ICE for that warrant, that she has an interaction with them, that she then says they should go talk to the chief judge in the building to try to resolve, you know, what they could do in that courthouse, right? And so the agents, at least some of them, do go to the chief judge's office to discuss it. And apparently the chief judge had been working on some type of plan to try to figure out in these situations where would agents be allowed to go,
mm-hmm.
where would arrest, if any, allowed to be take place, et cetera, et cetera. So the allegations are, when it comes down to with regard to Judge Dugan, is that while this communication is going on in the chief judge's office, is that she allegedly says to the defendant in her courtroom, who ICE is seeking, quote, come with me, close quote, and then allegedly leads the attorney and that individual who they're seeking to detain to a door that essentially leads to a non-public area and a way for them to get out. So that's the key allegation.
How is that not obstruction? That's a judge or anyone saying, you're about to be arrested, here, go this way instead.
Good question, John. But for federal obstruction, number one, I think she has some very good defenses. Number one, even according to the allegations in the criminal complaint, she did believe and took issue with the type of warrant that they had, that it was invalid, it was a wrong type of warrant, and therefore couldn't be used. So that was her issue. If that's true, and she had a good faith belief that that wasn't a valid warrant, then I think all bets are off. There's no obstructing anything. And secondly, you know, there's going to be a question of what immunity you have in your own courtroom. And thirdly, I do agree that they should have let the chief judge of the building handle it. You know, it was put in the chief judge's hands to decide, okay, here's what's going to go down or not go down in this building. I think that the way to handle it would have been to let that person make that decision. However, I don't think what the judge did in the courtroom is actually a federal crime. So that's where maybe we disagree, John.
Well, I mean, you know the law better than I do, right? I just feel like, and look, I think my bona fides are very clear about pushing back against an administration that I think might be acting beyond their scope. And I've been very clear on this show about following the letter of the law, like, and follow what the Supreme Court says goes, and any administration that tries to defy that, not okay. So I think my bona fides are clear on that. But people are really pushing back on me for just saying, just on a plain reading of this thing, at the very least, it seems incredibly improper. It seems like she didn't like the activities of the administration. She disagrees with how they're going about their deportation cases. She she saw an opening to say, hey, look over there, go talk to the chief judge, and then showed someone the back door. Like, during that, that just seems improper. And here's the example I want to give, Mike, to people that maybe are a little more left-leaning who are screaming at me right now, and I appreciate their passion. If this was a case about a January 6th defendant that the FBI was coming to arrest, and he was at court for something unrelated, let's say the judge in that case, who was more conservative-leaning, didn't like the fact that the FBI was arresting a bunch of people at the Capitol, had said, oh my goodness, the FBI is here to arrest you, or someone's here to arrest you, here's the back door, the left would be apoplectic. Yeah. So if that's the case, then we need to call it out on both sides when something's improper.
Yeah, no, that's a good argument. It's a good point. It doesn't change my views. The number one, I agree with you in the sense that I think the judge shouldn't handle it the way that she did, and she should have let the chief judge make the decision about how, if at all, an arrest could take place in that building and whether the arrest warrant was valid. And number two, I won't change my position that I don't still think it merited an arrest,
right,
and I don't think it's a violation of federal law. And more importantly, three, I still believe, in counter to you, and maybe it's not counter to you, that there is a strongly a strong political aspect
there's
to
a,
this.
There's a showmanship
that's
to
attempting
it.
To, you know, shoot across the bow, right, so to speak.
Yes.
So and to intimidate. There's no doubt in my mind. So people may disagree with that, but that's where I come down.
You think it's an intimidation from the executive to the judiciary?
Correct.
Yeah, I don't know. And the 773 says, hello, I don't understand why you're working so hard to say the judge in this case was at fault, John. Someone finally decides to stand up to this administration's ICE agenda, and you want to find fault with that. Shame on you. First they came for the immigrants, and I stood up because blank, 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 I know how the poem ends. I know how the poem ends as well. And I just feel like this is not a judge's role to stand up to the administration in any other way than a written opinion.
What I wish
like,
we could
like actually like this kind of like look over here as I do this out the back door. Like, can we all agree that that seems crazy or shouldn't be done?
Yeah, I agree. I think from that standpoint that a judge shouldn't get involved in that matter. I agree. It's not a crime though, and I don't think it's a federal crime. And I think that you shouldn't be arresting judges under these circumstances because there's a greater motivation behind that, in my view. Okay, but I agree with you. I don't think the judge should have handled it the way she did, but that doesn't mean you should be arrested.
That's fair.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and I guess that's where I see valid points being made. Should an arrest have happened? Did this have to rise to a federal charge against a judge? Couldn't there have been discussions behind closed doors about what's proper or not? Have the someone on the executive talk to the chief judge to talk to the judge about how she handles things? Okay, fine. I could maybe get with on that argument, but I just can't get behind the idea that don't look away. This judge did absolutely nothing improper.
Yeah, I mean, look, why not let the chief judge of the building handle the situation as it was in progress of being handled? There would have been a resolution one way or the other. I wish there was some judge out there, John, that would listen to your show. I wish your show was interesting enough to attract judge listeners, and there'd be a judge who might even come on anonymously and tell us what they think. But I think probably a lot of judges would say, too, that you know, it shouldn't have been handled the way it was, but I think they'd probably take great umbrage about arresting the person.
Yeah, that's fair. The 630, who wanted to know if I thought it was appropriate for the FBI director to tweet about an ongoing case. No, I don't think so. I would prefer they don't. The 630 then says, John, you're stating facts one side of the case that we haven't heard from the other side. I think Mike Leonard is honoring the other side. And nobody's screaming at you, says the 630. You're just stating facts that you have no knowledge of. So, 630, I've asked for any specifics they want to provide on the text line. I will read them on the air, as I always am well open to criticism of my own side of things, and I'm more than happy to rethink things if I'm presented with a different side of facts. Let's take a break. Maybe we'll pivot to something else. Ooh, greatest mysteries that have never been solved. Keep those coming in. We'll talk with Mike Leonard about what's going on his caseload. John, amongst all the legal talk, are you still referring to your baby son as kid or small goat? That was a carryover from yesterday. I was in for... I don't want to restart this whole argument here, Mike, but I was in for John Williams, and I kept on calling David my kid, and that really rubbed some people the wrong way. I didn't know that that was a thing that people say, don't call your children kids. It's very informal. Kids is apparently what you call baby goats, which I also didn't know, which shocked a lot of people. I'm not disrespecting them or my son. I just was surprised. I'd never heard that debate before. So
John,
I'm
shocked. I have four kids. And I still call them kids. And one of the kids has the nickname Goose.
Oh.
I really only call her, I mean, I call her by her real name sometimes, but I call her Goose.
That's cool.
Generally, I call her Goose.
Why?
I would never have a problem saying to anyone, how many kids do you have? I have four kids.
Yeah,
I'm shocked at that debate.
It's okay. I don't want to restart the whole thing because it caused a whole kerfuffle on the air.
But it's fun.
I've gotten yelled at a lot the last 2 days, is all I'm saying here. A lot more today on my stance, apparently, on this judge. Although a lot of people saying no, that absolutely, judges can't do these sorts of things. But some people seen it kind of both ways, that yes, this was improper, but an arrest seems to be overboard. Then the 216 probably sums it up best. He's the attorney, John. Drop it.
Wow. I love that listener.
It's a smiley emoji.
Send that listener a John Hansen mug. And a John Hansen t-shirts, because I know they're going fast, but I love when people yell at you other than me.
Yes, no, it happens a lot. I mean, yeah, it's impossible to, like, not get yelled at. We're a very divided country, and we all have opinions. And if you share your thoughts on a certain matter that seem contrary to what a lot of people, the general consensus of some listeners is, you're going to get pushback.
But I think it's good. I like the fact that we have all these great opinions
yes.
and going both ways. That's the key. Like, we can debate and argue these things all day long and not try to kill each other. You know,
yeah,
even if you're totally wrong, John, we don't have to call you names, you know.
You're working on a case. You're in the middle of a case. We won't get into the specifics of it until perhaps after it's over. But you are expecting a resolution on Monday? Is that when closing arguments are? Or?
Yeah, closings will be likely on Monday.
This is a federal case?
Yeah, so federal criminal trial in Chicago. So, you know, we could have a jury verdict Monday. We could have a jury verdict Tuesday. Who knows?
How long has it been going on for?
A whole week. Yeah, okay. A whole week. So it just reminds me of some certain things. Number one, no better way professionally to spend your time than on trial. I love it.
You love being on trial.
It's the greatest. But number two, how exhausted you are each day. And I think I was telling you off air, you just don't usually spend your day that locked in. Like, you're not listening to every word everybody says, you know, from the witness standpoint. You just don't do that in real life. So when you do that for like 5-6 hours a day, you're just at the end of you're mentally exhausted. But the problem is then you got to go home, regroup after eating, you know, 50 jelly beans or a burrito, and regroup and then like do some further prep for the next day. So
yeah.
it's just like a cycle of being tired, but also totally driven by adrenaline and anxiety, which I like too.
You probably spend what, 12 to 15 hours a day when you're in trial working?
Yeah, because let's say you got to get there at 9:30. So you're getting up early, kind of looking over your stuff, go downtown, then end of the day, get down at 4:30 or 5:00. Regroup for a couple hours and then hit it again. So yeah, I mean, it's just exhausting, but it's awesome. And the fun part about it too is like you have this idea of how it's going to go, what the witness is going to be like. You know, there's, you know, about a dozen witnesses or more, but you have this preconceived notion of like what your cross examination is going to be or how the witness is going to come across. And oftentimes you just got to regroup on the fly because things don't go the way you expect, or things go better or worse than you expect, or the witness comes across a certain way you didn't expect or anticipate. And so it's just a great mental game.
Yeah. You comparing like how attentive you have to be throughout the day and then prep the next day. It does remind, my mom was a public school art teacher for 30 some years, and just seeing her at the end of the day, just so exhausted because you have to be on with those students for 8 hours straight. I mean, maybe you get a lunch break or whatever, but then maybe you're grading and she'd come home and be building the curriculum or she'd be building something because she was an art teacher. So she'd be making like pottery at home to get ready to show the kids the next day. A similar profession where like you don't get to like just fiddle around on your phone for 40 minutes here or there just to clear your brain.
Yeah, exactly. And the weird thing is too, this case, I'm doing it with two other lawyers. So you'd think, oh, you know, you wouldn't be as stressed, but it's still the same thing, you know, because you're still always thinking about, if it's someone else's witness, you're still thinking about yours, but you're also thinking about taking great notes to help the other lawyers doing the examination for later for the closing argument. So yeah, just a lot of things go into it.
How many trials do you think you end up doing in a year? Because you can't exist on that schedule every single week, right?
No. I wish it was like TV where, you know, like Suits or something like that, John, you get the case 3 days later on trial. That'd be great. But no, for us, we go to trial pretty often, but that means more like every 4 to 6 weeks or something like
that.
Like this year in particular, we just have a lot of trial. If you look ahead on our calendar, it's like literally like every month, which maybe doesn't seem like a lot once a month, but it is because there's so much prep that goes into it. Yeah. And then you're solely focused on that. Like you only live that case and then the case is done and you start to live only some other case.
Do you have to like turn potential clients away simply because your caseload is too heavy? Meaning you don't know when you're taking on a case, when that will actually go to trial. There's going to be pre-trial motions. There's going to be this, that, and the other thing. That would stress me out so much, not knowing like which date everything is happening. What days can I have a vacation? What days can I not?
Well, but you do know. So like if you looked at our calendar now, you'd see all these X'd out times where we have a trial set or a hearing set or whatever, a sentencing. So, but when you take a new case on, you kind of understand the life and process of that case. So, you know, in a federal case, okay, if things go normally, we're going to go to trial in, you know, probably within 12 months, 18 months. So it's not like the case is going to go to trial in 3 weeks, you know? So, but yeah, some cases you turn away, you can't take every case, but you do have a sense of process and schedule. So when you get a new case, you know, it might be hot and heavy right away because you might have a bond hearing where you're trying to get your client out of jail so they can be out of jail while the case is going on, or you might have some key pretrial motions or hearings, but then the case kind of tends to settle into a particular pace.
When you're getting ready for closing arguments, as you are on Monday, do you have a vibe on how a case is going before you do it? Do you have an idea already before the trial even begins what your closing argument will be? Or are you responding to how the last week went, things that you thought landed well or maybe you could have landed better that now you're going to try and clean up and fix or reemphasize in your closing argument?
Well, number one, I'm not doing the closing because I'm doing with two other lawyers. So that's weird not to have to worry the entire weekend about the closing argument. So, but when you're doing it, there's a couple things. I mean, obviously there's things that you know you're going to say in your closing. You're actually trying to get little bits and pieces on every cross-examination out of witnesses so you can use them in your closing argument and say, hey, remember Joe Smith said this, which supports some part of your closing argument. There are lawyers that tell me, oh, you know, I write my close before the case starts. I've never done that. I mean, obviously, you know certain things you're going to argue in your course, because otherwise you can't cross-examine the witnesses, because the whole cross-examine witnesses thing is to use things for your close. So you know where you're going, but I don't write the whole thing up before the trial ever. But yeah, all sorts of things happen where, you know, you might have this idea that, you know, you're going to say this witness is totally not credible or the other way. And this is a live thing that just happened. So you, of course, you have to be responsive to what really happened at the trial. You can't, you're in isolation or something like that.
What percentage of cases, I'm trying to figure out the right way to word this. Not that you win, but like, what percentage of the time do you get right that the vibe you have right now in the stage of the trial ends up being what the verdict is? Are you pretty good at saying 85% of the time the vibe I have is the way this thing's going to turn out?
Really tough to say.
How about you hang on with that? We're going to go to the news. Mike Leonard will answer that question. And any of yours, we've got another half hour here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Open grab bag, 312-981-7200. Questions for a federal defense attorney. A good one, too. Mike Leonard, after this, and Sylvia Snowden's news. I almost said moose. Right when I put my headphones on, Mike Leonard, you always want to say something to me off mic. Maybe that's when you hurl your insults at me because I can't hear you when I put the headphones on.
I think you're wrong because I like you to hear my insults.
So before the break, you're in the middle of a trial here. It's coming to a conclusion likely early this next week. I asked, at this point in a trial, right, around closing arguments or even after closing, basically any time up until the jury renders a verdict, what is your percentage of guessing correctly what the verdict will be? Essentially, can you read the vibes of the room really well? And what do you think?
Well, number one, you always think you can, but you're often wrong. But no, here's the deal. The bottom line is this, is to try any case, you have to absolutely believe that you can win, right? No matter how horrible the case is or how great the case is, you have to believe there's a way to win it. So you always approach each case like, okay, we can win it. Here's how we can win it. Let's try to get our evidence in this way, or try to shape the government's evidence in a way that we can win. So, but no, the problem is no matter what happens, no matter how well it goes or how bad it goes, even when it goes fantastically well and you think, okay, we're in the game or we're going to win this, you still agonize every second the jury is out.
Right.
And you start to, within minutes when you're sitting around, you start to then critique yourself. Like, oh my God, I can't believe that I did this, did that, did the other thing. We're not going to win because of that reason. I suck. I'm never going to win again. And then you win the case. You know, so it's this bizarre mental game.
Please say I stink from now on. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that, John. But yeah, it's just this bizarre mental game that you're playing with yourself. But yeah, you have to believe you're in the game, which we are. And we got a great client who I really would like a good result for because he's a great guy. And I don't think he should ever have been charged.
Okay. So, don't try and influence any... I'm just kidding.
One's listening to us, John.
Well, a retired judge just texted in.
Oh, really? What did he say?
He or she said that the Wisconsin judge, we're going back to the Dugan thing one more time. I'm opening myself up for another beating on the text
line. Will the judge come on the air?
I don't know. 630 judge, you're more than welcome to call in. They say that the Wisconsin judge handled it correctly up until she led them out the back. She should have stopped after she referred this to the chief judge, which is what you said, Mike Leonard. It's not her call. He has an attorney to protect his rights. And that was sort of my argument, too, is why would the judge, I mean, she's an officer of the law or of the court, so I think she probably felt like she has a right to try and find out that everything was handled to the letter of the law. I guess it's like in your DNA as a judge. And if it's your courtroom, it's like the captain of a ship. I feel like you think that you have this bubble that is your bubble.
They do sure have that bubble. Yes. They do have that bubble. No disrespect, judges out there.
Right, exactly. But like for a client that is for a defendant who's in court for another thing, why is that her job to step in? Why does she think that's her job to step in and orchestrate one thing or the other?
Well, she obviously thought she was doing the right thing. But number two, I agree with the retired judge in that, and I said this earlier. Yeah. Like, look, there's a chief judge for every building. This obviously was already an issue. Okay, how are we going to handle ICE and immigration officials or law enforcement coming to the courthouse to try to detain people? And of course, that happens because some of those people have pending cases. It could be a criminal case, it could be a civil case. So obviously, that was something they were already discussing. So why not just let the chief judge make the call? Yeah. And then we wouldn't be in this controversy.
Right. More yelling at me on the text line. All right, we'll get to that another time. No, just the 630 and I are in a little debate about what obstruction of justice is or isn't, what it constitutes it or not. And I'll give people out there that don't think it rises to the level of obstruction of justice. In fact, you don't think it does, Mike Leonard.
Oh, I don't think it's obstruction. No, and I think that the judge is going to have very good defenses. Number one, clearly one of the defenses is going to be, I didn't believe this to be a valid warrant of the type that's necessary to detain this person. Therefore, the argument's going to be there was no legal process I could interfere with. That's a different issue than whether the judge should have handled it in a different way. Can we beg the retired judge or current judge who texted you to call in?
I don't like to beg people to call in. That doesn't send a good signal about.
Come on, John.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. If any judge or retired judge wants to call on in. But the other problem is that puts Iridian as our call screener and producer on the onus of making sure that they're an actual judge or not. So
yeah, what's the test for that?
No, I don't really know.
There's like a secret code that all the judges know that they only use for radio shows.
And they told Iridian it.
Yeah, so they say like, I don't know, what do you think the secret word is? Open sesame or something like that?
Yeah, maybe something like that. Yeah. Gavel is the secret word.
We haven't covered the high, John, you seem to be very out of touch this week because we haven't covered the Emo Jones Jr. trial.
Former state senate president, right?
I don't know about former state senate president, but current sitting member of the Senate, I believe.
Okay, yes. I know the name, and forgive me, I have a newborn at home. I can't keep every single case at the front and center of my brain, Mike.
Oh, yeah. So you have no time to watch 2, 5, 7, 9, 32, Fox, CNN, or read the Tribune or Sun-Times, and yet you're a radio host who's supposed to keep up on current events.
Wow.
In any event, so this was a pretty high-profile trial. Of course, when you're charging a member of the Illinois legislature, that gets a lot of attention. And it came down to, it's kind of a classic case we've talked about over the last 2 years. Yeah. So the allegations were that he was given $5,000 as a purported campaign contribution, and he was supposed to help a company that was involved with the red light cameras, right? And also the allegation was that this individual who was associated with the red light camera company had offered to, you know, give someone he was associated with, Emil Jones Jr., a job. The interesting thing about the case, first of all, hats off to the defense lawyers, Vic Henderson and Josh Adams, who did a great job just getting the mistrial, because I think there's a strong possibility the prosecutors don't retry the case because I think the evidence was weak. But it seemed like one of those cases where you had this nebulous, you know, alleged deal. It didn't seem like really a deal. And it's kind of weird when people can legally give hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars in campaign contributions, and yet you can single out someone who got a $5,000 purported campaign contribution under ambiguous circumstances.
I see what you're generally driving at with bribery, right? Like, we make donations to political campaigns, and a lot of times for big donors, that comes with an implicit ask of something, right? Especially like rich corporation owners or corporations themselves, they want favorable legislative pushes for certain things. But that's not bribery. That's seen as a campaign contribution. Yet a smaller quote-unquote donation or a handover of money can be seen as bribery if it does certain things. And you're saying that this case didn't rise to prove the quid pro quo-ness of it all.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the evidence was thin, that what they did was they propped up thin evidence with a lot of kind of, let's make Emil Jones Jr. look bad, you know, kind of text that showed he was out partying or whatever, stuff that I just thought was irrelevant. So I wasn't surprised at the result. I also thought, you know, they're probably close to getting a not guilty, but it was a mistrial, John, and I know you had a lot of questions about mistrials.
You're doing my producing for me here, Mike.
I appreciate that. I'm taking over here.
Yeah, so the mistrial essentially says this trial is over, and now it's up to what, the prosecutors to decide what to do next?
Correct. So most judges will let the jury deliberate a substantial period of time before declaring a mistrial, because oftentimes jurors are at loggerheads, could be early on, could be after a while. And so what typically happens, particularly in federal court, is the judge will say, okay, continue deliberating, you know, don't essentially give up your you know, well-founded beliefs, and, you know, but take a look at the evidence, you know, take a look at everyone else's arguments. But it basically tells them, go back and keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that'll usually happen once and sometimes even twice. But then ultimately, if the jury indicates they're, you know, hopelessly deadlocked on a count or counts, the judge will declare a mistrial, meaning no decision could be reached. The bad thing, if you're on the defense side, is that, yes, the case could be retried. That's up to the prosecutor's office to decide. I think the right thing in this case, since the evidence is weak, is to not prosecute it again, because I think they'll have a tough time proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
And spoken,
I think,
like a true defense attorney.
No, but
attorney.
It's true.
Okay.
I mean, if you saw the evidence here, I think it is not a strong case. So, but that's the problem. If from the defense standpoint, it's a win temporarily, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they may retry your client. So that remains to be seen.
Someone says it's not bribery, the donations we make to people. It's Citizens United. We have the best political and judiciary money can buy. Hello, Clarence Thomas. Okay. Yeah, the whole discussion of whether it's bribery or not to do campaign contributions is certainly up for long debate. The Supreme Court ruling that Citizens United means money is speech, so
yeah, I mean, the only easy cases, in quotation marks, are ones where someone says to somebody, hey, if I give you this, will you do that?
This.
And the other side says, yes, if you give me that, I will do that. That's what it's kind of coming to, but it is hard to square these, you know, tiny money cases to, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars that get poured into certain people's offices, and then clearly they take action on behalf of those clients, but no one can say it's a bribe.
Right, and even the order of operations has come under fire, and the Supreme Court has kind of ruled that it can't be kind of an after-the-fact gift. It has to go in that quid pro quo. It can't be quo pro quid.
Yeah.
Like the Supreme Court, and that threw a whole bunch of other cases into a mixer, into the blender.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, even the Madigan verdict will be hotly contested on appeal. And so that'll be one of the issues for the appellate court to decide. And as we've talked about, literally over the last 2 years that we've been doing a show together, John, it feels like only a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a big issue in so many of these cases. And the Supreme Court, from the defense bar standpoint, has for once, you know, move the law in a way that's favorable to the defendants, because, you know, federal law is very tough on defendants and defense counsel.
Thank you for that. Thanks for summing that up. I'm now up to speed on all things in that case. Appreciate it, Mike.
Yeah, just keep abreast of local news, John.
You're supposed to text me all week long what's happening in the court world.
I was like in a cave this week. I was just in a cave until I came out of the darkness this weekend.
Yeah, that's called being a parent of a newborn. You remember those.
I do. It's been a long time ago since
kids.
I had kids. Wait, can I ask, what are you supposed to call kids?
Like children or your son or your daughter.
Yeah, I do call them that too, but I don't feel any. If he had my kids calling, I don't think anyone would be offended.
Let's not make a mountain out of a molehill. It was a few texters yesterday. It's probably 95% of people out there say kids. It's no big deal.
Okay.
One texter did want to point out, who agrees with my take on the Judge Dugan thing, to say that, because I'm kind of talking about how some texters are upset with me, they wanted me to point out there are a lot of texters actually that agree completely with my take on the thing, that it shouldn't have been done that way.
So, oh, I'm sure. This is really a really interesting issue. I mean, if we didn't have such a policy debate going on and such acrimony over the administration and executive orders and such dividedness over immigration policy, you know, we wouldn't have such an issue. But we're in a crucible, so to speak, here.
We're on a, I have my team, you have your team. Anything that my team does, even if I don't really believe it's legal, I'm still going to support my team. That's like kind of the atmosphere now and has been for a while now.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have to, we all should be checking our own biases in that sense. That's why I kind of played out that January 6th example as just like a, well, how would I feel if it was on the other side of the other foot? And I wish we would all do a little bit more of that sometimes.
Yeah, I have to compliment you on that one, John. That was a very good, that was a very good hypothetical, like a law professor would pose to the students.
Oh, well, there you go. 2:49, we got to take another break. Got a few more minutes with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. And I would like to know if you have any other questions or comments or concerns for Mike Leonard. 312-981-7200. Or you can tell us the greatest mystery in the world that you want the answer to. We had a couple true crime cases. The JonBenet Ramsey case came on the line, a couple local ones. Someone texted in the Tylenol murders. It could be a bigger thing. I wanted to know Amelia Earhart, and Ridian had the D.B. Cooper jumping out of the plane. So are there any other ones? Jack the Ripper's come up as well. 312-981-7200. If there was one mystery of the world you could get the answer to, what would it be? We'll get a few more of those next. 630 says, not a murder mystery, but how were the pyramids built? That's from Brett. That's a good question, Mike. Any theories about how the pyramids were built out there you want to throw out?
John, that's way beyond my... I need to stay in my lane.
Yeah, you sure do. Yeah. Question from Patricia, my biggest mystery. Is Mike Leonard single?
No, John. Happily married with four kids.
Yeah, very good.
K-I-D-S.
312, one of the biggest mysteries. How did Lyle Lovett get Julia Roberts to marry him?
I love that.
Wow,
that's a great question. You know, it didn't last, though, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe that's your answer.
I don't know who Lyle Lovett is, so.
Dude, he's the singer. He's like a country-ish singer, right, Meridian?
Well, first of all, I love how I love how you say how do you not know who he is, and then you can't even identify.
He's actually a singer, country singer, very ugly. He is very ugly.
Okay,
yeah, tall and ugly. The McCann case is interesting.
So let me tee it up. The 262 texted on in the Madeleine McCann case, which was the British family that was in Portugal, and their daughter Madeleine, age 3, was we think kidnapped. From the hotel room, they were like at the bar. It was like at a resort, and they were having drinks with other family members or other family friends. The kids were alone in a series of rooms, and the 3-year-old disappeared. That was a huge documentary.
You know, what's interesting is that the Wikipedia for that case, it claims it's the most heavily reported missing person case in modern history.
Mm.
But I thought, and maybe the listener can correct me, I thought what made it so fascinating was the wrinkle is that I thought, and maybe I'm getting the case wrong.
Don't read.
I think I'm right, but I think the allegation was that the parents went down to the bar. I don't know if it's the same case or other heavily carried. Why are you wringing your hands?
Because you're just about to you don't know for sure what you're about to say.
No one's going to sue me, but I think one of these cases, the parents had actually given their kids like an injection to help make them sleep,
okay,
and it became very controversial.
Yeah, that does seem controversial. Yeah. If that is the case, I don't know. But that might have been a different different series. Hey, we're just about out of time, Mike Leonard. Just in time for someone to sue you for defamation on the case. Where should people be reaching you? How would you reach yourself if you needed a federal defense attorney?
I'd reach out. I'd call me, John, at 312-380-6559. Mike Leonard at LeonardTrialLawyers.com. Anybody who is facing federal or state criminal charges or is being investigated for them or has been contacted by law enforcement or has been asked by law enforcement to contact them, John, give me a call.
What was the number one more time?
312-380-6559.
Okay. Mike Leonard, good to see you again, my friend. We'll do it in a couple weeks.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.